Okay.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Take Aim, Accuracy in Media's weekly talk show on Blog Talk Radio. AIM is America's original media watchdog, and every week we point out biased coverage and bring you the stories the mainstream media ignore. We encourage you to visit our website at aim.org and sign up to receive our daily email so you can keep track of what the media are up to. I'm Roger Aronoff, a media analyst with AIM, joined today by my co-host Don Irvine, Accuracy in Media's chairman. Good morning, Don.
Good morning, Roger.
So we're ready to have another great show here, I'm sure, and we'll get started right away. Our first guest is on the line, and he is Luke Livingston, and why don't you take it from there, and I'll be back in a half hour to come on with our second guest, Bill Gertz.
Great. Luke Livingston is executive producer of the new Tea Party, the documentary film, that premiered here in Washington, D.C. on December 2nd. Luke, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself? How did you get involved with the Tea Party movement?
Well, Don, I entered the Tea Party movement back in March. My neighbor, Jenny Beth Martin, was very active in the local conservative movement here and was actually spearheading the events here in Atlanta on February 27th when there were several tea parties that spontaneously erupted around the country in response to the stimulus bill and Rick Santelli's call, you know, for action. And she invited me to join the planning committee for the Atlanta Tea Party. I'm a video producer here in Atlanta, primarily corporate work, business to business. But I had been involved in some local politics, and she thought I'd enjoy volunteering. So we did volunteer, along with some other talented folks, and we provided all the video on the Jumbotron screens at the Atlanta Tea Party, which ended up being this huge event.
So
and it was at that point that I realized that there's a story that needs to be told.
Okay, so then for the film, I mean, what inspired you to create the film?
Well, I saw the faces of the people at the Atlanta Tea Party. I saw the makeup of my neighbors and their grandparents and young kids and families and people that were scared and frustrated and articulating those feelings in their signs. And no one was there. I mean, there was no media other than Sean Hannity was there. But other than that, you know, there was not really any local media. CNN, most of the mainstream media ignored what was going on. And I felt, well, this isn't right. I mean, these people need to have their story told. And as the media started to apply all the labels of angry mobs and astroturf and racists and all that kind of stuff, I mean, I felt like, you know, disparaging some pretty good people that you know, feel strongly about, you know, their principles, and this is all wrong. So I felt like, well, you know, let's tell their story. Let's find out who they are. And the Tea Party movement's huge, right? It's a mile wide, but the coverage was about half an inch deep in the media. And I want to go deeper than that. I want to be able to see what really moves these people to action. These are reluctant protesters. These are people that have never gone out to a rally before in their life, but something moved them to action. I understood it was, you know, government largesse and you know, overreaching government and spending. But I want to know a little bit more about why, you know, conservatives were moved to action. So that's why we produced our film.
Now, as I looked at the film, and I thought it was a terrific film, you focused really on the stories of five individuals. You know, how did you select those individuals? And why don't you give our audience a little bit of a background of who those people were and why they're in this film?
Well, sure. First of all, most of the coverage of the Tea Party movement, at least from any kind of sympathetic point of view, was basically a YouTube clip, some man on the street interviews, and chats of signs, and some speakers talking, and that was it. There was nothing that really went down into the reason, justification, the core principles of why these people were doing this. And I thought, well, I need to go deeper than just throwing a microphone in someone's face and asking them a question while you're here, you know, and showing some signs. So I said, well, the best way to do that is to follow some people on their journey into activism. The overarching story ended up being the 9/12 March on Washington and their journey from local rallygoers to, you know, national activists on the national stage at the U.S. Capitol. So we started to attend. I started to attend some local Tea Party rallies in the area, and identify individuals I thought would be interesting subjects for the film, because I knew that that was going to be a great story if I could mix a little bit of reality television and follow some people, along with some telling the history of the Tea Party movement and experience their what I'm calling the journey into activism, their personal movement, then I'll be able to understand what the principles are and be able to expose what the movement's about. So I went to one rally in Canton, Georgia, a small town, and there were about 75 people, the healthcare rally, a Tea Party rally. These were being held nationwide. And one man, Jack, stepped out into the edge of the crowd, stepped out in the middle of the circle and said, you know, I'm going to find three people in 30 days. And I'm going to do something about this. 8 days ago, I was on the couch, but now I'm going to do something about it. I'm going to find three people in 30 days. I challenge everybody here to do it. And I thought, wow, here's a man of action. I'm going to, you know, and I started interviewing people like him along the way. I said, who am I going to follow? And these people allowed me to do that. That was Jack. He's our everyman. He's a guy that shares the same passion that almost every conservative activist feels right now. We wanted to find somebody that had been an Obama supporter, but then, you know, was disillusioned by, you know, Obama's switching position on many things, you know. So we found we went to a rally and interviewed some people and found Nate. Nate's a young African American guy, you know, more libertarian in his views, but somebody that was disillusioned with Obama's focus on growing government over the individual, and you know, has a compelling story. We also deal with the issue of race with Nate, you know, and talking to him and finding out how he feels about things. Jenny Beth Martin is a movement leader. I wanted to find somebody that was a movement leader that could talk a little bit more about that, you know, about how things were pulling together and get some behind-the-scenes footage. Jenny Beth's a friend of mine. Any documentary filmmaker will tell you that access is very important to a documentary, having access to the topic. Jenny Beth provided that. Healthcare was an issue that was obviously moving to the forefront over the summer, and as they tried to ram that legislation through. So we found a doctor who's an activist, you know, a working doctor, and it was Dr. Fred. And he's a urologist. He's active in a grassroots doctors organization called DocsForPatientCare.org. And, you know, we talked to several doctors. Fred was the one we decided, hey, this guy really, really cares about his patients. And the reason he's in this is to provide better care for his patients. So very compelling story there, as he goes to the Capitol with about 2,000 other doctors and storms the Capitol on December 10th. And they actually take over a hearing that Conyers, Representative Conyers, was hosting about single payer. And it's a fascinating and very riveting story. Or section of the movie, I think. And then there's William. And William is a pastor. We found out about this guy down in Brunswick, Georgia, who was a colonial reenactor, and we found out he's a pastor later. But he's a gregarious and fun and exciting type of individual, very spirited, you know, love of life. And our producer, Jessica, went down several times and captured his steps into the journey, and he ended up being a fascinating character in this film. He actually led the march down Pennsylvania Avenue on 9/12. You know, he's a pastor, but he's a pastor of a Baptist church, and it says a majority of the congregants are black. So, you know, you say, wow, this is really interesting. We're able to deal with these accusations of racism by hearing from some, you know, young black guy who is you know, would like to have, you know, more individual liberty and less government. And we have a pastor who cares and loves for his flock, and some of them are African-American, right? So that's, we feel we can get into the the nooks and crannies of this racism accusation in our film, and I think we refute it fairly well. And then there's a young guy, Dave, who's one of the three people that Jack was trying to recruit, and Dave's just a young man, you know, that wanted to do something and felt, you know, he needed to do something interesting, you know, to stand up for individual liberty, and he's also in the story. And then there's some minor characters like Paul Kurtman, and Paul was a Marine veteran, young man, who stood up at a town hall in Missouri where Claire McCaskill was early on in August, and demanded an apology from Claire McCaskill for supporting several issues that he didn't agree with, and to a standing ovation of the Tea Party goers at that meeting. And then Paul Kurtman then moved to several platforms. He was jettisoned to the national stage because of that YouTube video. He was on Hannity the next day and all that. And then he began to take advantage of the platforms, I think, that God provided him to speak out about the issues that were important to him. In fact, he actually moved into running for state office in Missouri because of his speaking out at his town hall meeting. So that's kind of it. And then there's other figures we have in the film that I would call more at the less grassroots and more at the leadership level of certain things or coordination levels. I mean, we talk to people at Americans for Prosperity, Freedom Works, like Dick Armey, and Andrew Breitbart is in the film. He talks about how the media labeled the Tea Party movement. So that's a long-winded explanation of things.
You mentioned at the premiere that the movie was somewhat of a struggle to assemble in such a short period of time. How long did it take you to put it together, and how did you manage to do it?
Well, we started shooting footage back in April at the Tax Day Tea Party events, and we found footage from people that had shot back, contributors back in as early as February. The focus, of course, was leading up to August and leading up to the March on Washington in September. So we came back from that whole week in D.C., at the 9-12 March, we shot events leading up to it. Now, we came back with about a terabyte of high-definition footage, which is several hours. And then we continued to follow up with our individuals and talk to them a little bit more about their experience and more interviews. So we were shooting all the way through September and even into October. Post-production started, I think, what was it, about October 8th. So it was about 8 weeks of post-production. We crammed about a lot of content into 100 minutes in a very, very short period of time. I mean, we'd spent some. I mean, I'm not a young guy, and I remember the young days when I was a young television producer doing overnights, and I hadn't done that in a long time. And here I am sleeping on the couch of my edit suite while we're trying to, you know, get this thing cranked out to make our Thanksgiving deadline. It was pretty intense.
So what were some of your greatest challenges in putting together the film?
That's a good question. Well, I'm more of an operational guy. The director, Pritchett Cotton, and producer, Jessica Levi, you know, handled a lot of the content. I mean, telling the story, we don't have a narrator. There's no narrator in this thing. We didn't write it. What we shot and recorded along the way informed our story, because it is a documentary, although we had so many interesting events that it ends up becoming more of a movie. But I think, you know, trying to explain what's at the hearts of the Tea Party movement, you know, making sure that was compelling and interesting to people. I my goal was to, number one, was to tell the story, you know, of the Tea Party people. You know, who are these conservative activists, and what's really at the root of this, and what's the truthful representation of who they are. Do it in an entertaining way. Make it entertaining. Put it in the context of, you know, what people are used to seeing in the theater. Something interesting. You know, they can laugh, they can cry, they can enjoy the film. They're not going to walk away bored. They feel satisfied with spending the money or whatever time they spent. And then the third goal was to honor God in what I was doing. I didn't want to do anything that was going to be something I couldn't show, you know, people that my friends and the people I hang out with and be embarrassed about. So staying within those three goals was a challenge to me. we wanted to make sure that we did that. Technically, obviously, it was quite a mess producing a high definition film that's 100 minutes long. Financially, this is all done out of cash flow. We have volunteers. A lot of the process was new to me.
Well, that's an interesting question, though, right there. It's just in terms of the financing of that, I know you kind of donated your time and your resources there, but how do you pay for all of that? It still costs money.
Well, I mean, I have a nice facility here in north of Atlanta. We have a couple edit suites and a small studio. So I was able to dedicate that the facility to the project and my time. The director, the producer, Joel Aaron, our marketing guy, everybody, volunteered time, hoping that, in the end, some DVD sales would make up for their time. There was opportunity costs on my part. I had to turn down a couple clients for this, which I hope they forgive me. But, yeah, I mean, the whole thing was done for under $20,000 in cash.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, because we had to pay for room and board up in D.C. But when you don't have any, when you're not paying for any labor, and you don't have to pay for any room rates for editing and so on, you can do things fairly inexpensively. And we didn't really have to buy much. Now the stock footage, I had to buy Rick Santelli's clip from CNBC, which they approved the day of the premiere. So we're cutting that into another version of the film. We had to buy some stock footage from AP and so on. So that ends up being our biggest cost right there. But yeah, it is amazing. It's I don't know, what was Blair Witch done for? $10 or something? I mean, this film was a labor of love for the people that made it. It's truly a grassroots thing. This is anything that was supported by a big oil and gas and all these other accusations that some front group for some gigantic mega corporation put together. It cracks me up when the news comes at you with that. I mean, this is truly something where we felt, those of us in the movement felt, the movement story needed to be told in an honest way because it was being ignored by the mainstream media. And we wanted to make sure we got that out. So that was a driving passion all the way through this. And one of the most interesting things about this story, I think, is how it all came together. Here it is, the 8th of... 8th of November, or 8th of October, excuse me, and we need to cut together a movie trailer. So we have no marketing budget. This is a grassroots thing. Nobody's going to know about this. Nobody knows about anything. So how are we going to get the word out? Well, we knew we had access to Tea Party Patriots through Jenny Beth, and maybe they'd help us with a mailing. I was involved with putting together clips for the March on Washington. So I knew that I had access to people within FreedomWorks, and I knew, gee, maybe they'll help us, and they'll blast some stuff out to some. We knew that we could take advantage of some of the same grassroots channels that were available to the grassroots networks. And that was the biggest expense. And I guess back to your question about the biggest challenge was marketing. It was easy to put the film together; it was cheap. But when it came to getting the word out about everything, that's where all of a sudden we started spending money.
Well, that leads me kind of into the next question. I mean, what is your vision of the future of this film in terms of what's the next step? What's going to happen?
Well, the next step, the distribution plan was very unconventional. We knew that we had access to grassroots networks, so we worked that in the beginning. We sent T-shirts and we put together a dynamic trailer, which was what I was starting to get into in my last explanation. It's a different story, but we put together a trailer that was almost epic. We wanted to do something that really kept people guessing. And we said, look, this is going to be a great, high-quality film. So we put together a trailer that got on YouTube and caught the attention of a lot of liberals. And they all said, what is this, a spoof? Is this a joke? Is this The Onion? Is this a Saturday Night Live thing? This is ridiculous, you know. But it drew a lot of interest. And then we decided to get a hold of activists, grassroots activists in busy Tea Party cities and areas and send out a box of posters and T-shirts and a 28-minute segment of the movie that introduces our characters but doesn't show the march and all that kind of teases them, and said, look, this is a preview. And we got that out there. And that started to generate some buzz, okay? And then we did get some help from FreedomWorks. because they lend muscle to grassroots efforts in a great way. And they were able to get us out on a mailing list blast that generated more interest for the preview and things like that. So we really kind of came from the bottom up with our marketing, because we were going to go straight to DVD. And then the next step was, nice website and getting the movie out on the website. And slowly, people have been catching attention because there's really no other film about the Tea Party movement. It caught the ear of the media left and right. And people started saying, oh, it's the Tea Party movie. What's that all about? So it generated some buzz, which is great. I'll be on the Fox Business tonight with David Asman on his show. MSNBC, Rachel Maddow, they attacked our movie right away because it was associated with FreedomWorks. And then I was on MSNBC last Friday, and this is a talking head, and the guy unloaded on me about how this is all just a big fraud and everything. You don't understand. So, now what we're trying to do is just, take advantage of the help we're getting and earned media to try and get the word out about this film. And we're putting reviews up on our website. I mean, people watch this film, Don, and they get standing ovations at the end. People are shouting at the screen. They're applauding. They're laughing. They're crying. This is a very entertaining movie. No one's wiggling their seat going, man, I'm tired of this, We don't have an expert who comes in about, body space analysis for how many people were actually on the mall. We talk about the passionate feelings of people and the struggles they go through, and people identify with that, and they love the film.
One of the things I'm curious about in the film, something that I was kind of fascinated with, was when Dr. Fred was up on the hill and he went into that, was that a hearing that John Conyers was holding?
He was holding some kind of health and information hearing, and it was all about single payer, and he had all these Canadian doctors or Canadian guys in there. Some guy was a former head of the Manitoba Canadian health government thing or something. I don't know who these people were. We had to blur them out because we didn't have rights to use them. But, these doctors, they were just on the hill lobbying. So they storm into Conyers' hearing. Storm. They were very polite. They all came in to sit down and listen to the hearing and see what's going on. And it's funny because the single payer guy is talking to everyone in the room saying, I think that single payer is the magic solution and all this. It's funny. And then the next thing you know, the doctors are asking questions of John Conyers there at the podium. And he's being very polite. And then he's allowing the doctors to actually, ask questions and express their concerns about the government's not listening. The doctors are saying, we are, caring for patients every day. I don't know who you're listening to, but, our patients don't want this. And then next thing you know, one of the doctors from Georgia is Canadian. Okay, he gets up there, and he starts debating with Conyers, over several things, including tort reform, and explaining that the reason that he came to America to study medicine because he admired the United States of, medical system, and here's a Canadian, and so he's talking, and he takes over and starts speaking from the podium at a hearing that Conyers intended Canadians to present their point of view at, and here we have a doctor that's opposing that on the side of free markets, taking over the meeting and running it. It was really amazing.
Yeah, I did. That's why I thought that was rather remarkable that Conyers, pretty much yielded that meeting like that. He wasn't really overly belligerent. I didn't think during that he was actually quite polite, which was surprising.
Well, yeah, he was. He was very gracious. But in the end, I think he was frustrated because the doctors where they're lobbying were about free market solutions and don't want single payer. And he became a bit frustrated, I think, because they were coming at him, pretty directly about challenging him on things. And at the end, he said, I think he got kind of frustrated. He said, the reason that Republicans won't vote for my health care bill is because they want to embarrass the first black American president, And all of a sudden, the doctors they kind of dropped back in their seats and said, whoa, wait a minute, we didn't come to talk about that. Where'd that come from? And the whole tone of the conversation changed, and the doctors just said, they were kind of laughing, saying, this is ridiculous. And, you know, I think it just shows that you know, when you're in opposition, you know, I think these doctors learn that sometimes, you know, congressmen and politicians may lend you an ear, but in the end, they're just going to vote the way they want anyway. And I think it's a bit frustrating to them.
Well, let me go back to the media for a second here. I'm sure you remember the first set of Tea Parties back, really, I guess, in that March-April time frame, and how CNN's Susan Rosen harassed Tea Partiers in Chicago. People all over America got upset. They let CNN know it, and next thing you know, Susan's contract, if she went on vacation, I think, right after that, but after she came back, CNN decided not to renew her contract. I guess Tea Partiers get credit for getting one biased reporter off the air. And what do you think about that?
Well, we do cover in our film. We do cover, you know, the labels that were thrown onto the Tea Party movement by the media. The Andrew Breitbart, we interviewed him, and he talks about that. You know, we actually had access to that footage, but it was too late. Someone who was standing there with good footage of that whole event that happened in Chicago. We don't spend a lot of time in our movie trashing the media, trashing Obama, trashing Pelosi or Reid. We really don't. I wanted to spend time talking about the principles of the movement. There is a lot of media bias. I mean, that's the whole genesis of the reason we did this. That was ridiculous. That the reporter, she just didn't understand. And the media bias comes out big time. I mean, I'm starting to see that now, Don, in the reviews that are coming out on the film. You know, things like that. You just go, man, these people just, they don't get it. They don't get it. They're never going to, because they have to speak from their worldview and their point of view. And what are you going to do, you know? If that's their worldview, then they're going to report from that worldview. And, you know, as much as people in our audience are gripped and moved to tears over things, they just scoff at it, you know? What am I going to do? I mean, we have moments where we have people honestly, sincerely, you know, and dramatically, you know, engaged in the process. And, you know, you come away from, you read an article from some liberal blog or some liberal, you know, like Talking Points memo or something, and the guy's just, oh, it was just, you know, it's all a scam. You know, what are you supposed to do? I mean, I can't help it. I look at the reviews that I'm getting from the people that are watching this film, and they love it, and they're proud, and they feel like they're not alone. And they have something to rally around and show their friends and say, this is why this is so important to me. And that really is very fulfilling, to get those reviews and to hear about how people are on their feet and they have something in their collage, their media collage, that is positive. I mean, if you had a middle school kid and you sent them, you gave them an assignment and said, look, I need you to put together a poster board collage of multimedia about the Tea Party movement. It would be the kid would come back with something that's really very scary, you know, angry mobs, racists, people with guns, you know what I mean? There's nothing there that's really positive, and our film does that. It's something that is honest and positive and uplifting.
Well, Tea Party's become quite a force, too, I think, politically. We're seeing, I think it's in Colorado, there's a candidate that's kind of running under a Tea Party moniker, and he's outpolling everyone else, it seems, at this point in time. And
yeah.
We do see news reports about this, that, and on Tea Party. There was an article in the Washington Post this morning on the Tea Party movement. With the media, I mean, how long do you think they can continue to either ignore or resist this? And continue with that attitude of, well, they're, you know, everything that you said, they're angry, racist, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, the left and the media that they control will continue to diminish everything. They just will continue to do that. Even though Rasmussen, recently came out with a poll that said that Tea Party candidates were 23% and the GOP candidates were, 18, something like that. And, you know, what the GOP needs to do is inculcate the principles, or at least go back to the principles of the Tea Party movement. I think what Senator DeMint says, he said that the Tea Party movement is not pulling people away from the GOP. The the Tea Party movement is an effort to bring the GOP back to the principles, to the original principles of conservatism. And, you know, I don't know anything about, I'm not a spokesman for the Tea Party, but I can say that everybody that I know that's involved in the Tea Party, that is involved in local politics here, like for their state house and our city government, they're all part of the GOP, you know? So I think Tea Party, you know, the people that go to the rallies and are upset about politicians in general just need to take those simple principles of constitutional limited government, fiscal responsibility, and free markets, and just, you know, start making sure those are the core principles again of the GOP. I mean, that's basically it. That's my opinion.
Well, Luke, we need to wrap this up. Our next guest is on the line. Appreciate the time you took to speak with us today. You want to give our listeners a website or any information they can contact you and get the film?
Sure. The website is www.teapartymovie.com. And they can order the DVD directly from there. We're offering a buy two, get one free special right now. And also bulk orders available for large Tea Party groups. It is a group of it is a movement of large groups, so people can go on there and buy bulk orders, and we'll waive the licensing and screening fees so that Tea Party groups can show it to, you know, large groups and things like that, and offer the DVD to people in the group, things like that. We want people to see this.
Well, great. I appreciate that, and hopefully we'll help chin up some sales for you.
I sure appreciate you having me on, Don. Thank you so much.
All right, great. Thanks a lot. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Okay, that was a great interview, Don, and we're going to get immediately into our next guest. Got Bill Gertz on the line. Bill is the acclaimed defense and national security reporter for the Washington Times, the author of the New York Times bestsellers Enemies, Treachery, Breakdown, and Betrayal. His latest book is now out in paperback. It is called The Failure Factory, How Unelected Bureaucrats Are Undermining U.S. Security. And you can follow him regularly at his website, The Gertz File. That's at gertzfile.com. That's GERTZFILE.com. Just let me say a couple other things that people talk about this man in this town. The Washington Monthly said Gertz is legendary among national security reporters. He is the envy of his competitors. Even the Washington Post said he is the hottest reporter in town. Gertz breaks dozens of stories every year. Bill Gertz, welcome to Take Aim.
Hey, good to be with you.
Great to have you on. We're going to definitely get into talking about your book, which again was recently released in paperback, but I want to cover some other topics first and then we'll come to that. You recently wrote, and I believe you broke this story, that the Obama administration was engaged in back-channel communications with the Taliban insurgent movement to try to settle the Afghan war before he announced his policy. Is this what caused the delay between the time that General McChrystal his recommendation was released back in, or leaked out back in August, and finally Obama made his speech last week at West Point?
Not sure. Those were based on reports out of Pakistan that the talks were being held indirectly through Saudi Arabia and Pakistani intelligence with the Taliban. But I think senior Obama administration officials have said that part of their strategy is to try to peel off some of the Taliban that are considered reconcilable, as opposed to those that are, you know, hardcore Islamist terrorists, as part of a bigger strategy. I don't know if it's going to work myself, but I think also that Holbrooke, the special envoy, has addressed this and didn't deny that there were talks with the Taliban, but said that there were no direct U.S. Taliban talks.
Do you think if the talks had gone differently, he would have made a different speech? Any way to know that?
No, I think that his speech to me was basically sounding retreat from Afghanistan, even though he announced the surge of 30,000 additional troops. This is the second strategy that he's unveiled. The first was in March. It was an obvious failure. They had spent quite a bit of time on that first strategy, and that this was supposed to show that the Obama administration was thoughtful and looking at all the options, and then they focused on this notion of AFPAC, Afghanistan, Pakistan. It was a failure, and even Defense Secretary Gates and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Mike Mullen, said that things weren't going well, and that's when McChrystal made his assessment, and then they announced this new strategy, which seems to have been refocused on Afghanistan and less on Pakistan, mainly because they can't get the kind of cooperation they want from the Pakistanis to really go after those sanctuaries and safe havens in the ungoverned areas of Pakistan.
Just about 3 weeks before the West Point speech, word leaked out that Obama was rejecting all four of the options that had been presented to him. And then, but is this final policy that he announced last week, is that really different from the four that were presented, or do you think something else was going on there?
The key feature of the latest strategy is this notion of an 18-month deadline. And, the president was fairly uncategorical. I mean, fairly categorical that, in 18 months, they're going to start coming out. Since that, he made that comment at West Point, we've seen both the Secretary of State and the Defense Secretary kind of put their spin on it by saying, it's not a hard and fast deadline. It was. It was clear. The president made it very clear. 18 months, they're going to start coming out. So this is a big mistake, obviously, to give the enemy the idea that they're going to have a deadline. I wrote in my Inside the Ring column today about an assessment from Afghanistan from a military officer there who addressed this part of it and said, basically, it's clear that this new strategy was not well thought out. It was an attempt to mollify the anti-war liberals in Congress.
Right. So we noticed, as you say, over the weekend, Hillary Clinton and Gates seemed to be backtracking from what he had said. And do you assume that Obama had been in on the discussions, that they were going to change the tone of the plan there? Or do you think they were just trying to sort of cover for him or protect him a little bit?
Well, it's not clear to me. I mean, the question then is, who do you believe? Do you believe the president of the United States, or do you believe his Secretary of State and his Defense Secretary? My view is, if the president said it, the people under him are going to respond accordingly, so that in July of 2011, they're going to start making plans to pull out the troops. Most of the additional ones will not have arrived there yet, so... And the other thing I noticed in the president's speech at West Point, not only reading between the lines of things like the deadline and trying to mollify both sides of the political spectrum, but if you looked at his body language, it was clear the president was not united with this new strategy. He was hesitating in certain points. He was not fully. You didn't get the sense that he was full of confidence about applying this new strategy. So. That's also a very troubling sign.
As I pointed out, you've been known for having some of the greatest sources at the Pentagon over the years. So are you finding there to be any unrest at the Pentagon over the direction that we're going in Afghanistan?
I wouldn't say unrest. I'd say that there is concern, and a lot of, not a lot, but some military people that I've talked to have said, hey, look, I'm putting my life on the line. I'm putting my time and my career in this. And, if we're not going to stay the course, why, what am I doing here? That's kind of some of the comments that I've heard.
Well, do you expect there possibly to be any high-level defections from the administration?
No. My experience with the military is once they get past three stars, I can't think of a single senior military officer who has resigned in protest since General Singlaw back in the 70s over Carter's announced plan to withdraw troops from Korea. They just don't seem to be willing to put their stars on the table anymore for some reason. And it's probably the result of this kind of bureaucratization of the military. And it's kind of a problem. Since the Clinton administration, they've kind of tried to move away from the warrior ethos in the military, so that you tend to get more managers as opposed to warrior leaders, although that's not completely the case throughout the military. There are a lot of really good warrior leaders, but none that seem to be willing to fight very vociferously for their positions.
To the extent that there is one, can you define at this point an Obama doctrine regarding foreign policy?
Simply put, it's arms control over defense, and we're beginning to see that. The lead item in my Inside the Ring column today talks about the Obama administration planning to try and seek Senate ratification of the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, which was voted down by the Senate in 1999. And unfortunately, the Republicans at the time didn't have all the votes they needed to completely kill this treaty, but now, and as a result, it was tabled and through a procedure, and now Obama is trying to resurrect that. They're trying to redo another START agreement. The people in the senior policy positions are of this mindset that arms control is the highest form of defense. And the problem, of course, with that is that throughout history, we've seen that the U.S. abides by these arms control agreements, but the states that we make the agreements with generally violate them. And obviously, the Soviet Union and Russia are the clearest examples of that. You know, I reported recently that the Russians are already violating the 1991 START agreement, which just expired on December 5th, and they are planning to start cranking out a new mobile triple warhead missile, which is a violation of the START agreement. So that's the kind of problem. So I would say that it's almost a Jimmy Carter and definitely a Bill Clinton style arms control over real defenses approach.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. You know, what is the significance of the fact that this deadline has just passed without renewing the START treaty and with regard to the Russian nuclear arsenals? Is this something that Obama's been pushing for and he can't get the Russians to go along? Or what's the significance of the fact that this hasn't been renewed?
Well, the Russians aren't getting what they want. They know any time you negotiate for a deadline, and their deadline was, you know, the administration announced they wanted to complete a new agreement by December 5th. And, of course, the Russians jumped on that and are trying to get more and more concessions. We've already made significant strategic concessions, like canceling the ballistic missile defense interceptor site in Poland and Czech Republic. The Russians still didn't play ball. That was done, you know, they skewed intelligence on that to try and say that the threat from Iranian long-range missiles was further down the road, when in fact this was clearly done to try and get the Russians to agree to a new arms treaty. The arms agreement, the START treaty, is problematic. They went from a 700-page document that had very detailed provisions for on-site verifications, inspections, challenges, to a 45-word joint statement that said, well, we're going to continue along. There's no way to verify what the Russians are doing. And, of course, as I mentioned earlier, the Russians were preparing to go outside of the START treaty with this new SS-27 ICBM as soon as the START treaty was finished. There's no way for us to verify that now. And yet they're trying to hope that this, basically a gentleman's agreement with the Russians, is going to keep the arms control regime going. So it's a big problem.
Well, yeah, at the time that Obama decided to back off of the missile defense position that we had, you know, people wondered, well, is he getting something in return for that, or is this just sort of a unilateral act, hoping that, you know, the Russians will take it as a gesture of goodwill and then respond accordingly? What did you think about that at the time and now?
Well, it was a betrayal of our Eastern European allies, who invested quite a bit of political capital to agree to host this interceptor site. The Russians, of course, issued all kinds of all nature of threats against both Poland and Czech Republic, you know, up to and including, you know, aiming nuclear missiles at them. Another threat was to deploy short-range missiles in Kaliningrad, the Russian enclave on the Baltic Sea. They've also threatened to do other strategic weapons developments. And, you know, I don't see any concession that was made in return from the Russians. This was clearly a unilateral concession that the Russians pocketed and did not respond to. And I think the true test of that is that they were unable to get this rapid agreement in time for the December 5th deadline.
There's another deadline that had been talked about that had to do with Iran, that they were basically being given till the end of the year to make some kind of commitments that they were not going to be engaging in developing nuclear weapons. And, you know, we've gone through these few steps where they were going to have their uranium enriched outside and then brought in, and then they've dropped that. So as we approach this next deadline, is there any indication that the Obama administration is ready to become, you know, more sort of confrontational and try to get sanctions imposed, or are they just going to continue to hope for this negotiations to succeed?
Well, if I were to predict what's going to happen, first of all, yeah, they have set the end of the year with their big engagement policy with Iran, with an effort to try to coax the Iranians into some type of agreement that would halt their illegal uranium enrichment program. You know, the press has really given the Iranians a pass on the fact that they are in violation of their agreement to the International Atomic Energy Agency not to do the kind of uranium enrichment that they're doing. They violated it. And yet nothing, and of course the Iranians have dug in their heels. They're saying it's their right as a nation to develop this, even though they have tons of oil and don't really need nuclear power, as they claim that their program is for. And the signs are getting worse. You know, just in September, and this really proved what I reported in the failure factory, that intelligence bureaucrats had undermined the Bush administration get tough policy on Iran by putting out this bogus national intelligence estimate in 2007, which falsely stated that Iran had halted its nuclear weapons program in 2003. Then, of course, the same year, we now find out from last September, they were building a secret military facility at Qom, which was, by all measure, a military uranium enrichment facility for nuclear weapons, not for you know, electrical power generation. And, of course, you know, the intelligence community has been silent on the false estimate, which undermined not just U.S. pressure, but European pressure on Iran. So now they've done this again, and the Iranians are going to basically try to make some public gesture that will try to loosen the pressure on them and allow them to buy more time so that they can ultimately fashion a nuclear warhead for one of their medium-range missiles. It's a very dangerous situation.
Obama received his Nobel Peace Prize this morning. Do you see that as in any way sort of handcuffing him from being more aggressive, or, you know, what did you make of his acceptance speech today, and how does this prize affect American foreign policy and at this point?
Well, it was, the obvious thing was that this was way premature. You know, he had done nothing to earn a Nobel Peace Prize, and it's not clear to me that this was something that will affect his policies, other than it will increase his stature as a world leader. But as far as what he will do In response to that, I don't see any major differences coming out of him winning the Nobel Peace Prize.
One more question, then we will get into your book, and that is, this week was the announcement about the breach of security with the TSA documents posted on the website revealing how we go about security at the airports and what countries, the 12 countries that we, in essence, profile people coming through from them. Do you know anything about that we haven't heard, or tell us your take on that?
Well, you know, I mean, basically, you don't want the bad guys to know the types of security procedures that are done at airports, and because that has been, you know, one of the front lines in stopping terrorists. So the fact that some of the details that are used to screen airports security, it was a pretty bad breach. They fired five TSA employees, but you know, overall, it was probably a relatively medium grade security failure.
Okay. Now I want to talk about your book again. It's The Failure Factory. The subtitle is How Unelected Bureaucrats Are Undermining U.S. Security. And you just a minute ago gave an example of this NIE, National Intelligence Estimate report that came out 2 years ago this week, I believe, in December of 2007, and you talk about how this came out, just a few people at the State Department. Tell us a little more about that and you know, the implications of what this says about what's happening in our government and at the State Department.
Well, I think the outrageous part is that, you know, this premier product, the National Intelligence Estimate, NIEs as they're called, are supposed to be the product of a broad range of intelligence analysts. It's supposed to be based on secret and unclassified intelligence information. So the point being that this premier product is supposed to be a guide for policymakers. But in this case, as I show in the book, you had three intelligence bureaucrats who basically usurped the authority of the policymakers, and they did it for political reasons. They believed that the Bush administration was going to take military action against Iran, and so they, according to the officials I interviewed in the book, this was the motivation behind putting out a false estimate. And it was, again, instead of being a broad-based consensus, it was done by three officials under the leadership of a guy named Thomas Fingar, who was the deputy director for National Intelligence for Analysis. In other words, he was the most senior analyst in the U.S. government. And, he's now left government, and he's gone on to Stanford, and I've tried vigorously to contact him there to ask him, now that this new Qom facility has been discovered, if he still stands by his NIE of 2007, and he would not respond to any calls or emails. So it's obvious to me that he's basically in hiding, and the set of estimate was discredited.
So what was the Bush administration's reaction to it? I mean, did they realize they were being undercut or undermined, and did they try to fight back?
No, they didn't, because they didn't understand politics, and they didn't understand how to fight for your policies, basically how to fight and win for your policies. That was one of the big failures. The clearest example of that was the fact that, I disclose this in the book, that the White House made a command decision in around 2004-2005 time period that they weren't going to defend the Iraq war. And this was a huge failure. In other words, they just opened up for the opponents, the liberal Democrats in Congress and elsewhere, to launch merciless attacks on their policies without any defense. And the decision, the false decision was made that we're not going to look backwards, we're only going to look forward. And, you know, this really hurt not just the country, but the entire effort to wage the war against Islamist extremism. I would say that after terrorism, the single most important threat facing the country is the problem of China. And I highlight this in the book, how there's a kind of self-delusion within the government bureaucracy, the liberal-dominated government bureaucracy, that has made it very difficult for us to come to terms with the growing threat from the People's Republic of China, Communist China, which is building up its military forces by any objective measure on a war footing. And yet our senior leadership continues to put out false propaganda that China is, quote, not a threat, that the buildup is insignificant compared to U.S. military power. And this is one of the most serious problems facing the country, is the threat from a nuclear-armed communist dictatorship in China.
Well, as I the thesis of your book, The Failure Factory, is to do with liberals basically being sort of held over from the Clinton administration, and as well as big government Republicans who and these career bureaucrats who adopt these policies. Now, I would say many of them are probably very sympathetic with what Obama is trying to do. So, it might things sort of the culture may have changed there. I mean, tell me a little more about that.
Sure. Well, this is a look at how, you know, an administration can come and an administration can go, but the bureaucracy is remaining the same. And my argument is that this is a 90% liberal-dominated bureaucracy. That, and the problem has been that, you know, you need a system in government, just as in business, you need a system to get things done. But what has happened over the years is that this bureaucracy has turned inward and looked at itself and is more concerned about protecting its own budget, protecting its own political turf. And this has been extremely damaging to U.S. national security. I could tell you horror stories about how intelligence agencies are fighting against each other, not over any strategic goal, but over petty bureaucratic differences. The classic one being the CIA and the FBI fighting over who has authority over various aspects of intelligence gathering or counterintelligence.
We're running out of time here, but one or two more things we'll try to get. One thing, has your working at the Pentagon beat, have doors closed to you that were open before? Even, for instance, Gates, who stayed on, I'm just wondering how your newspaper, how you were treated there compared to before.
Well, it's always interesting, you know, as different administrations come and go. The Bush administration was basically hated the press, and to their own detriment. You know, they didn't see the press as a way to advance their policies, and consequently it was pretty much a failure toward the end there when it tried to, from a policy standpoint. The Obama administration, on the other hand, is much more press friendly and tries to use the press to its advantage on the one hand, but on the other hand, it also could be very valuable. I mean, we're still early in the administration, but I'm optimistic that I'll be getting a lot of good stories, because most of the mainstream media will not be interested in covering a lot of the real issues that are coming up, like missile defense, like the arms control fights, like changing the law on gays in the military. So there's going to be a lot of good stories in the coming months.
Okay, Bill, why don't take your last minute or a few seconds here and tell us again where people can find that book and your other books and your website, and
sure.
I urge people to definitely follow Bill Gertz. Go ahead.
The book's available at all bookstores. It's The Failure Factory, and it's also available on my website, which is The Gertz File. It's GERTZFILE.com. And I also post a lot of my stories and my Inside the Ring column there as well.
Okay. Well, listen, I appreciate your coming on. It's been great having you. And again, it's always a pleasure following you and seeing what you're writing about. So
Thanks very much.
You bet. So, folks, this has been, we think, another really interesting show. Hope you enjoyed it. And tune in to our website, aim.org. I have an article on the White House gate crashers, and we will be back next week with another very interesting show. So stay with us. Thank you so much for being here.